OWC Radio number 49, a great conversation with John Ross. I'm Tim Robertson, and this is OWC Radio, episode number 49. I've got a cool guest this week, and I'm really looking forward to learning more about him. His name is John Ross, and what I do know is he's a retired Navy chief, balloonist, scuba diver, and underwater photographer. That's a mouthful, John.
I try to keep this.
But that's not everything, is it?
No, I've been involved with technology. I'm a wood turner.
I'm
really proud of the fact that I have 4 children and 10 grandchildren, 8 granddaughters, keep me really busy.
Sounds like you're busy enough as it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to. I'm retired twice. I'm retired from a technical college up here in Wisconsin as well. Spent 15 years as a dean and 10 years later as an instructor in IT. Always taught classes in IT even before I left the Navy and retired. So it's been something that's been a passion of mine since 1971 or so.
Well, let's go back in time. How did you join the Navy?
Well, that may not be able to go on the air, but I'll give you the story anyways. I was a young kid in the inner city of Boston. I used to park my car and ride my horse, and eat my potatoes and tomatoes with the best of them. I was born and raised in the north end of Boston on Hanover Street, right there with the old North Church and Paul Revere and all that.
Sure.
And I was a typical inner-city kid, and at 17, during the course of the summer, a bunch of us guys got together with a bunch of our girlfriends and had a little drinking card party, and I decided to pass out in the middle of a 5-way intersection on the way home.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And long story short, the judge said, it's time for you to get out of Dodge. And so he pointed to a neighbor recruiter in the back, and the neighbor recruiter said, I can get him out of this. And so my mother, crying away, signed paperwork, and I found out 3 years later they'd had dinner the night before, and everybody decided, my friends and my uncle and my mother, that it's probably a good time for me to leave town before I got myself in any kind of trouble. So
A good way to do that is to serve your country.
Well, I was 17 years, 0 months, and 0 days the day I raised my right hand.
Wow, really? 17 years old. Now, this was during the Vietnam era, correct?
I spent about a year or 2 years between Washington, D.C. and on a ship, and then later on, and then started moving my career on. I went overseas and went into Vietnam and did some intelligence gathering or electromagnetic propagational studies. I was on a sister ship to the Pueblo, and we did a tour on the ship in Vietnam, and then came back here to Wisconsin to build a jet gunboat and a 165-footer, and ended up sailing that back around through Panama Canal and back across towards Vietnam, and came back and flew back and married my girlfriend that I had met here, and we've been happily married for 45 years now.
And the end.
Well, yeah. I stole her away. You know, I had about 5 or 6 years in the Navy by then, most of that overseas in the Far East. And I said, I asked for a hand in marriage the old way because I was raised Sicilian. You have to do that.
Sure.
And, Mom and Dad gave me their blessing, and I stole her away. She was the oldest of 8 children. And so I took the oldest away from the family, and we bounced around the world from island to island. Lived in some really exotic places like Eleuthera in the Bahamas and Midway Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and Hawaii. And we just kept, as I changed to that intelligence field, and I worked underwater surveillance systems during the height of the Cold War. I was the operations chief for the Pacific side for a while.
That's an important job.
Yeah, it was. It was the third best kept secret in America. That's between the Manhattan Project and the Polaris missile submarine and then the sound surveillance system. And served my country for 20 years, and then in 1984, my wife said, when you're done fishing and diving, come on home. But we had 4 children by then. We had 3 boys, adopted a girl from Korea, and we had 4 young children, and she said, it's time to leave the Navy and go back and visit my family for a long, long, long time. So I thought naively I'd be here in Wisconsin for 3 years, and I've been here for about 31 now.
Yeah, it's a great place, though.
Oh, it's a great place to raise a family. I can't complain at all. like I said, I have four children live around us, and they've blessed us with grandchildren, and can't complain whatsoever. I didn't lock my door till about 10 years ago. That tells you something.
So what's the biggest things that you took from the Navy into civilian life?
Well, number one, I was a Navy Chief Petty Officer, and you have to understand that culture. The Navy is kind of unique between the four services. Most services have enlisted and officers, and the Navy has enlisted Chief Petty Officers and officers. And pretty much, I was groomed and trained. I had 158 young women and 18 guys I was responsible for, and I was 36 years old, approaching 37 when I was going to retire. About a $13 million budget, that's more people and money than most CEOs have. It's the old adage, tell the chief what you want, get the hell out of the way, let the chief get the job done. I told my people and we got the job done. So I came away from the Navy with a sense of organization and how to work with people and accomplish goals, set goals and attain them. I also was lucky. I was involved with the nuclear power program for a while. I was an electronics technician for a while with radars. I got into the computers very, very early. Picked up a commendation for that, and it helped me advance to Chief Petty Officer. I used to program programmable calculators, if you can believe that.
Yeah, I can. Absolutely.
Yep. And actually got a medal for that, so that was kind of interesting. But I took Dutton's navigation and decided that this could really help us track enemy submarines and things like that. So I took the Dutton's navigation programs and programmed them into programmable calculator mag strips, and then we distributed those around the stations and around the Pacific so that people could use them to help them do their job better. So it got me involved, and I knew that I was going to retire from the Navy, and the Navy is really good about, I mean, all the services are. They're really good at encouraging people to pursue higher ed. So I started at the ripe age of 28, went back to school, and while I was in the service, and I went and picked myself up two associate degrees and a bachelor's degree before I retired. And then after that, I did a master's and other credits beyond that, postgraduate courses. But
any of your kids follow you into the Navy?
My oldest did. My oldest did son went in the Navy, did exactly what he said he was going to do, like Dad did. He went overseas for a couple of years. He came back, built another ship for the Navy, did his 4 years, got out, got married, raised a family, that kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
The other three children chose not to, and the service is not for everybody. What it gave me, and probably what you asked the question of originally, was about 3.5 years of schooling over the course of my 20 years. And it prepared me to be qualified to get a degree in computer science, number one, my bachelor's. And number two, I had a lot of work experience in the early, early days of computers. When I say early, one of the first persons I met when I was 17 was a Navy captain by the name of Grace Hopper.
Hmm.
And she's the lady that coined the term bug. And I was involved with computers from the early onset in the Navy, as we, of course, the job we did was pretty highly important, so they were throwing new technology at us all the time. And we went from computers that were water-cooled to computers that were finally solid-state. My first computer was MITS Altair.
Yeah, sure.
Lights and switches in San Francisco.
Yep.
About the time the Homebrew Computing Club was kicking up, I was playing around in that community. I had the first hard drive, I think, in the Hawaiian Islands.
Really?
It was 5 megabytes.
Huge.
The size of an overhead projector. I think it cost $1,207 or something like that. And when you consider what we walk around in our pockets today with flash drives, it's absolutely flabbergasting.
Yeah, moved fast.
Yeah, you think. So the Navy gave me a highly technical background. They gave me leadership skills, and they gave me the ability to have a thirst for learning. So I stayed in education, which, being a high school dropout, not proud of that, but being a high school dropout, when I finally got my head turned around and went back into it, when I was living on a place called Midway Island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, Gilligan's Island in your mind, basically my chief at the time turned around to me and said, you know, you're not going to believe this, but we're going to make you the training petty officer because you're the best we've got for training people. And we think that you just don't realize it, but you found your forte. And they were right. I've been involved in education since 1976 now, and that's what I do. And my background, as we started to allude to, you know, I was involved with very early on in the 80s when I retired. I had been fortunate enough to work at a college that was on the bleeding edge of technology with IBM. And they installed the first professional office system here, for example. And one of my instructors, I flew him to Rochester, and he saw the first AS400 mini computer that ever was made 6 months before it rolled out. So we were always on that bleeding edge, the cusp of it, and I was involved with PC user groups. And for 20 years, I was a product review editor. And we had a team of people doing product reviews, and we did all the Comdex spring and fall shows, and the Association of PC User Groups was very, very big until along came a thing called the Internet. And as the Internet kept growing, the the necessity for user groups started to wane, and it started to fade away. And I was advised at that time by a good friend of mine in the industry who runs a big PR show at the trade shows, Steve Leone from Showstopper, said to me, yeah, you know, John, you got a knack for talking, and you got a knack for listening to people and interviewing people and talking with them. You ought to move into broadcasting. So about that time, a local radio station here, Wynwood Radio Group, has about six radio stations here in the Valley, and they were looking for somebody that could be a technology person for them. And they're and so they came to the college, and we happened to have a speakers bureau, and of course, with my big mouth, I guess I was just naturally speakers bureau. I spoke all around the country and around the world on technology for the college and doing in-services and flying out with Xerox and IBM and doing different programs for them as well. And so I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. And I've been doing talk radio up here in the Valley, kind of like a consumer electronics evangelist, essentially, for the last 13 years or so, AM talk radio. And once a month I come in and we talk about all the things that I've either learned about. I've got a lot of contacts in the industry and the press side of the house, and they send me a lot of information and material and products to review. And I pretty much got out of the product review business when I decided to get out of the user group community, and then it pulled me back in again on the radio station. So I just kind of dabble at technology, and that's the best way to describe it for you.
So let me ask you, as someone who does broadcasting, traditional broadcasting, mm-hmm. and you've been doing it about as long as I've been doing podcasting. I'm coming up on my 12th year. I started in podcasting pretty much right when podcasting was invented.
Sure.
And I've enjoyed the the freedom that podcasting has allowed me in both expressing my opinion, saying what I want without having a program director over my left shoulder going, no, you can't say that. But I've been pretty successful at it. Has someone like you, who's been in traditional media, looked at podcasting with disdain, or something that you might be interested in doing yourself? Or how does someone that comes from AM radio look at podcasting, which really kind of invaded your turf?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I love it. I mean, I'm a consumer of podcasting. I try to find different podcasts that I like and enjoy, and I listen to people. I don't always agree with them, but there's so much to technology that no one person ever can encompass the scope of what we need to talk about and help out people with.
Absolutely.
So I'm looking for podcasts continuously. What I do, you know, I love to do underwater videos and photography on turtles and whales and things like that. I've been diving since 1962. Okay, that's a long time.
It is.
And I've been in photography from the embryo days, whether it be on the surface or underwater. You know, back in the military, you could buy cameras and lenses during Vietnam overseas for literally a song cheap. And so when I retired, I gave my kid brother-in-law like six cameras and 18 lenses because he was in a photography class at the university and said, have fun. But what I've discovered is that I cannot have all the information at my fingertips that I need. And if you look on traditional broadcasting, exactly like you alluded to just now, you really can't get the answers that you need from a traditional broadcast. I'm a fan of Leo Laporte, and I've known Leo for over the years. I love listening to his show on weekends here in the Valley area. But again, he's under that constraint, and he's working with advertisers, and he's doing a lot of things where with a podcast, you can get succinctly what you're looking for. Because if you don't like it, you'll find a different podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And podcasting allows a specific topic to be the whole show. I mean, you're not going to get a national radio show on, you know, underwater photography. It's just not going to happen. But you can totally have a podcast doing that. And you could find, you know, that micro broadcasting audience that, you know, maybe there's only 300 people in the whole world who's interested. I know it's a much higher number, but half of them are going to be listening to your show. Exactly. You're going to be servicing that specific community, which you can't do that in traditional broadcasting.
No, you cannot. And the hardest part I have, and I think my listeners ask me the same question all the time, is how do you find them? How do you find those pearls? I'm always looking for pearls.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find those pearls where, oh, this is a podcast that I'm going to subscribe to? I mean, I'm a technology guy. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at my desktop. You know, the i6 Plus, the MacBook Pro, the iPad on the Mac side, and a brand spanking new Windows laptop, and a high-end gaming machine, and all the different devices connected in the house and all that. And when you think about just the things that I like to be interested in, I could probably think off the top of my head of about 25 or 30 different arenas where I need to find podcasts that deal with different technologies.
You don't have enough hours in the day.
There is not enough time, literally. The biggest thing on my show this month is maybe someone asking me about Windows 10. And just trying to dive in and learn enough to be literate enough to talk about it is too time-consuming based on all my interests. As you know, you alluded to, I fly balloons, and I fly all over the world and all over the country. And I'm, you know, I was in Montreal for 2 weeks, now I'm back, and then 3 weeks from now I'm down in Albuquerque, and then I'm back, and then I'm down in Arizona, and I'm back, and I had a chance to go to Ireland. I passed on that because it was just getting scheduled. Well, when you combine that kind of thing with all the technology things in my life as well, there's not enough time in the day. And I really, truly like to go out of my wood shop and turn a bowl or two if I can, because to me that's like reading a good book. So
yeah, lose yourself in it, huh?
And podcasts the same way. You have to be a smart consumer of educational technology. I need to say that slowly to you again. You need to be a smart consumer of educational technology. For example, when people say to me, well, how do I learn about this? I say there are resources out on the web that you can learn about anything if you so choose.
Yeah, absolutely. I get that question as well, especially, believe it or not, from still new Mac users. How do I really start learning how to do this and do that? Go to YouTube, listen to some podcasts. I mean, the resources out there, which we didn't have available to us even just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is amazing what you can learn very quickly from the comforts of your own home. I mean, stuff that would have cost us, you know, $20,000 in college tuition.
Exactly.
It's just free now.
Well, I'll give you a classic example. And because of what happened this past winter, and the experiment I went through with Larry and with this whole Mac upgrade system, I was doing a show on this. I learned that, not to give them a plug, but they've earned it. I had a question that related to my MacBook Pro. First thing I did was I went to OWC. I went to their support desk and I called them up and I said, hey, listen, I want to put two monitors on this thing, two big 24-inch monitors, because I want one for editing and one for processing to do some video editing stuff. And they were there. They had all the information at their fingertips to say to me yay or nay. In this case, because I had a mid-2012 MacBook Pro, it's not possible even to add a box to do what I really want to do. And so, but I could have spent days or hours trying to find a third-party product that would let me do that. But I knew where to find the resource to say succinctly, hey, this is what I want to do. Is it possible? And the answer was no. Move on. Try a different thing. So I think you need to be an educated consumer of where you get your answers and build yourself a nice little database of what are the things you need to have to help you survive in today's technology world, okay? That's my opinion, personally.
I totally agree with you. For those who are wondering, longtime listeners, yes, I do have the dreaded three random questions for John Ross. We'll get to those later in the show, though. You got to prepare yourself. You got to be ready for that, John.
I'm ready for whatever you want to throw at me.
So how did you get into ballooning? I mean, look, I'm from Battle Creek, Michigan. We had a balloon festival since the early 80s here.
Yep.
And you used to come to this balloon festival back when it was a good balloon festival, and it's really not anymore, but that's a whole different topic. I've seen your balloon in action. Of course, I couldn't point to it now, but I used to go to the balloon festivals all the time.
Sure.
You used to fly them. How did Navy, education, photographer, balloonist, you're either way down in the water or way up in the sky here, John.
It's a real simple equation. I tried to go to ground school a couple times in the Navy, and the Navy transferred me. So I knew there was a message from somebody that said I wasn't going to be a pilot. And I came here to Wisconsin, and I still had this burning passion. I've been a member of the Experimental Aircraft Association, EAA, for, I don't know, 30 years or more. And I'm really involved with, and I truly enjoyed my naval aviation side as well. But I really wanted to be a pilot. And I went out to the airport out here, and I said, I think I want to be a glider pilot. My brother was thinking about it, and I thought about it, and I said, I want to be a glider pilot. And they said, that's a great idea. We only have one small problem. What's that? Well, we have a gliding school. I said, yeah, I know that. And they said, well, it's moving today. It's going to be about 2.5 to 3 hours south of us down by the Illinois border. And I went, you got to be kidding me. So not only did I get transferred, but now the gliding school was going to be transferred. It was a message from somebody saying I was not going to be a pilot. And believe it or not, I was in Lou Key down in the Florida Keys blowing bubbles on a night dive and went into a 19th hole type bar afterwards to get a burger and a beer after diving at night, doing some underwater video work at night with turtles. And the fellow there happened to be from Wisconsin with me, and he said, by the way, have you ever flown a balloon? This was back in like 92.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. He said, well, you ought to try that sometime. You've done helicopters and patrol planes and all this kind of stuff, but you really ought to try a balloon. I said, sure. I got a call about 2 months later, and he said, where are you? We got 38 rooms. There's 100 balloons at the Wisconsin Dells for a big festival, and my guy does a family reunion, and he's got the whole hotel reserved, and come on down and meet him. So I hopped in my car, drove down, and next day I took a ride, and happened to be a ride with the governor, in fact, and the balloon was because of the Wisconsin balloon. And that one ride has probably cost me $125,000.
First balloon. I was going to say, it's not a cheap hobby at all.
I've had three different balloon systems. My first balloon, the whole system only cost me $2,400.
Oh, that was cheap.
In the trailer. I mean, but like anything else, you buy used cars, you buy used balloons, then you buy a newer used balloon, then you buy a new one, and you know, things start adding up. took my first flight, and it was like, this is it.
For those who have never been on a balloon ride, I have. You know, watching balloons from the ground, big hot air balloons, you would think, it must be great to be up there and just kind of floating. But you don't get that sensation now, for those who are wondering, never been in a balloon. You don't get any kind of floating sensation. You're just standing there.
Exactly.
What was it about it? What was the sensation that drew you back? Is it the height? Is it the view? What is it exactly?
Well, I'll tell you what kept me in ballooning. I've got about 800 hours in ballooning now, and I've flown in 17 countries. I've flown in some of the most exotic places you can imagine.
Yeah, I said Battle Creek.
In New Zealand, I sat in Bilbo Baggins' chair in the Shire.
Did you really?
It does really exist, honestly. It does. Beautiful country. But, I mean, I've been to Europe and flown in Europe as well, and then across Mexico and Canada and the U.S. Flying is great. I truly, truly enjoy it. After 800 hours, it better, you know.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you that ballooning is a friend and family sport. And it's the social aspect of ballooning that probably kept me hooked more than the actual flying. Like I said, I've flown all kinds of special shaped balloons and regular balloons and experimental balloons. And I've flown in Monument Valley and the Valley of the Gods and in Utah. And I've flown in Albuquerque with 1,000 balloons in 2000. 1,054. We broke the Guinness record. But I've done all that stuff. But the thing that keeps bringing me back to ballooning is the friends and the family part of it. It's a social animal. You can't do it by yourself very rarely unless you have an experimental balloon. You're flying on a tank all by your lonesome. But in reality, you've got to have crew with you. And I think the camaraderie before and after the tailgate parties, the dinners and the breakfasts and just that whole social atmosphere, it's a community. And it keeps drawing me back, and it's been drawing me back now for 24 years. So I thought nothing would ever, and probably still has not, surpassed diving. But the idea of being weightless underwater and being motionless in the air kind of complement each other.
Oh, I can imagine. How does your wife feel about the ballooning? I have to assume that she probably doesn't mind at this point.
Well, actually, she does.
Does she?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she asked me to begin with, please don't buy one. I know you want, you know, you become a pilot, but you know, fly somebody else's balloon. Well, that's ancient history. But she's flown once in 24 years. It's just
once?
Once. It's her cup, not her cup of tea.
No, wow. But see, I would have figured, as you're talking about family and all that, that she's into it.
No, she's a very, very wonderful person. She has her things, and I have my things, and I've been a very, very lucky man that she's allowed me to continue in what I love to do, and she's never actually ever said no, you know. So I've been very, very fortunate. I consider myself extremely lucky.
Does she dive with you ever?
No, she can't. She snorkels. She has never had a desire to be a diver. She loves getting in the water. She's an avid water person as far as, you know, body surfing and boogie board and stuff like that when we go back to Hawaii. And she just truly enjoys that, but it's just not something that ever tripped her trigger.
I think she's a keeper, John.
I figured that out a long time ago.
So you were talking about updating your Mac. What Mac do you use on a daily basis?
Well, I've got a MacBook Pro, and I also have an iPad. And so I have a MacBook Pro laptop, and I have an iPad, and I have an iPhone 6 Plus. So mm-hmm. that's my Apple world, along with Apple TV and all the external drives and all that kind of stuff that you know use. I use the MacBook Pro for my daily business. I use it for editing, although I'm trying to learn how to edit on both platforms, both photos and video. And I haven't done a lot of audio editing. I'm not into that side of the house. Did that back in the 60s and kind of gave that up a long, long time ago.
It's a lot different now.
Yeah, you think. I had a very interesting experience. You know, I know a lot of PR people, and Andy's a good friend of mine, Andy Markin from Markin PR, and he works with OWC, Mac Sales, or whatever.
Andy was the one that sent me your contact information. Absolutely. And introductory email to get you on OWC Radio.
And by the way, Andy's also a diver as well.
Is he really? I didn't know that about him.
We do a lot of diving. We never dove together. We're always in Hawaii at different times every year. I go back every year to get some time. We spent a lot of years in Hawaii, and I love it there. And I've got a lot of friends, and we dive and fish and have a good time. But I had an idea for a show, and it was based on a caller. A caller come in and said, hey, should I upgrade my Mac or should I buy a new one? And I said, that's a fascinating question. Normally, you know, you just kind of give the off-the-cuff answer. And it made me pause to think. And I said, you know, you have just given me an idea for a show, for a theme. And I like to do that. I like to pick up on themes and then run with it and get enough corporations, companies involved that allow me to put it all together and do something with it. So I approached Andy and Larry at CES this past year. And we'd actually danced around this subject a year before, but I never moved forward with it. But now I got serious about it, and I said, listen, I've got a 6 or 7 year old MacBook where the hinges are coming out of the screen almost, and it's really time to it's one of those, you know, when you float test it, you throw it over the side, and if it doesn't sink, you keep it.
Yep.
And I said, it's either time for me to buy, build, or upgrade. And Larry looked at me, and he's, you know, Larry O'Connor, and he said, you know, I got an idea. So what's that? He said, why don't you buy one of our refurbished MacBook Pros. I'll send you which one I want you to buy, and you tell me that you want that you're going to purchase it, and then we'll throw some technology at you, and I want you to go through the whole experience of what a user would go through if they contacted us. And so I did, and I documented that, and I purchased a refurbished MacBook 2012, mid 2012 MacBook Pro, and they were kind enough to give me an SSD and a data doubler, which allows you to take the optical drive out and move your hard drive over in the data doubler side. And so I have the SSD for booting up my programs, and we took the MacBook Pro to 16 gigabytes of brand new memory. And so here we're talking about a 2012 MacBook Pro that sings and dances. It's got like I said, it boots off of the SSD. I got the hard drive where the optical drive used to be. Most importantly, this conversation, though, really, Tim, is I kept documenting all of my contacts with OWC support for any reason. I wanted to see the experience of receiving a unit, purchasing or acquiring other technology, and now could the average user, not Mr. Techie John Ross, but could the average user take what came in the box and go through the whole process? I was flabbergasted how superiorly easy it was to do that. They even sent me all these little plastic screwdrivers, the right sizes and all that, nut drivers and all that. And they pointed me to the links on the website where the videos were to show the neophyte exactly what to do step by step, and how to replace the optical drive, how to put the SSD in, how to put the memory in.
Even just how to take the computer apart. I mean, a lot of people listen to this have never taken...
Never look at the back of a MacBook. You don't realize how many screws there are on the back.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And they're different lengths and things like that. And whoever made the videos did an excellent job, because they took it from the same attitude of first-time person doing this. You know, they need to have a cup to put the screws in, that kind of thing. You know, all that
stuff.
And waltzed me right through the process. So I went bingo, bango, bongo, and I did exactly what was recommended. You know, I did the memory first, and then I did the data doubler move, and I put the SSD in, and I followed the process the way they wanted me to do it. I had one hitch, and it was a software glitch. I called them up. A fellow was on the technical support, said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to do this. I want you to do this. Tell me what this is doing. Yes. Let me take control. Let me look at that. Boom, boom, boom. Do this, John. Thank you very much. It worked. And it's worked seamlessly since that day one.
You know, I'm actually using exactly the same MacBook Pro that you're using, 15-inch.
Yep.
And I've got the data doubler in it. I've got the SSD in it.
Yep.
My setup is almost identical to yours, hooked up to, for me, a 27-inch monitor. And I usually actually close my lid. The 15-inch monitor is great, but I don't really need it when I'm using a 27-inch monitor right in front of me.
Do you use a Bluetooth keyboard then with it?
No, I don't. You know what I actually use?
And
I'm a little bit old school. You could appreciate this. For a long time, my favorite keyboard was an IBM Model M. I love those keyboards. Clickety-clack, right?
Right.
Drives my wife crazy with that keyboard. I was talking to a fellow, and he suggested, well, he told me he got an Apple II extended keyboard from the 80s and 90s.
Yep.
And he's using that with his. And I said, well, how are you connecting it? Because remember, that's got that weird ADB plug. Well, that's just an S-Video cable. It's the same cable. Mm-hmm. So I bought a Griffin iMate, which they don't make anymore, but you can find them on eBay for $5. I went to Best Buy and picked up an S-Video cable for $2. I plugged my recently purchased Apple Extended 2 keyboard into it, plugged it into my Mac, works perfect. Didn't have to do a thing.
Well, the part that I've recently been struggling with, and they gave me a really clear answer right away to tell me no, was the mid-2012 only has one Thunderbolt port, excuse me.
Yeah, Thunderbolt, not Thunderbolt 2.
Not, just Thunderbolt. And basically, what I really wanted to do was put two 24-inch HDMI monitors up, you know, and then just run the two monitors so that I can do all my stuff with Lightroom and Photoshop and whatever else I want to work with. And the answer was no. There's just no way with the way the present configuration to do that. And Larry, by the way, actually told me that. I remembered it after the fact. He told me that at CES. He said, now, I'm going to recommend a mid-2012. It's only going to have – you can't do Thunderbolt 2. You can't do some of the new technology that we're throwing out right now. He said, so what you're doing is you're taking that step up, but you're doing it for about half the cost of what you're going to spend if you out and go to Apple and buy yourself a brand new one.
Yeah.
And so if money is an issue, the upgrade to me is painless even for a neophyte to do. I mean, I would give the video and the instructions to my wife, who she's amazing on a computer as far as surfing the web, and you know, she can search things better than I can and email all that stuff, but she doesn't take computers apart and put things together and build computers and things like that I've done over the years. I would give that same box to her, and she would have done the same upgrade, I think. So a person who is financially constrained, absolutely no problem recommending, and I have over the air, by the way, no problem at all recommending that they go through the upgrade process on their Macs if they want to.
I always tell people upgrading your Mac is going to get you another 2 to 3 years out of it.
You're going to stretch it out.
Yeah. For me, I think probably in maybe next year, but chances are it's probably going to be 2018 or 2017 before I really decide to buy a new machine. And my only fear about buying new machines, John, is that they're not as upgradable anymore.
No. And that's an Apple, what's the word for it? Culture.
Yeah.
That's an Apple culture that's been developing, especially as we get new people now at the leadership helm. I think you're going to see that more and more. I have a big old home-built gaming slash simulator computer downstairs in the PC world. And you know, I've got this. Whenever I walk into an Apple store, like down in Phoenix, I live down there in the wintertime south of Phoenix, and because you don't want to live in the frozen tundra if you don't have to. Whenever I walk in there, I get big screen envy, I guess what you want to call it.
Sure.
I can really see one of those 27-inch Macs, you know, sitting there on my table downstairs, rather than at the PC world. And the only thing that keeps me in the PC world, truly, is that because I do product reviews on both sides of the house and I get calls from listeners on both sides of the house.
You have to have knowledge.
I need to have that knowledge of that PC world. So
yeah.
my man cave downstairs is going to be the PC world and my office is going to be the Apple world.
Well, look, I have a PC here myself. It's a Dell. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much bone stock, but what I use it for, there's a few things on the PC side that I like to play with, but it's basically one of my arcade machines. That's its main purpose. It sits inside of an arcade cabinet, and you know, I've got a joystick and a, you know, all that stuff. But it's basically a gaming PC. But the games that I play on it are very, you know, most of them are the 80s Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man and Donkey Kong. And this machine is way more power than I need to play those games. But it also allows me to occasionally jump on Steam and download a newer game and play it that way. That's just not on the Apple side. Gaming on the Apple devices have never been all that strong. Well, on Macs, it's extremely popular on iOS. Gaming is this off the charts. Not so much on the Mac side, which is a bummer to me.
Well, I think you're going to see a merger. I think we're all seeing that. Those of us that are familiar with the Mac world, you're going to see the merger. It's coming. That train's coming down the tracks.
Well, let me ask you about a little bit of speculation here. A lot of people are speculating, and I don't like talking about rumors, so I'm going to stay away from rumors, but I will talk a little bit of speculation. A lot of people are saying next week, and I'm going to be live tweeting this event, the Apple event next week, new Apple TV,
yep,
and it's going to be a game changer. It's going to have apps. It's really going to focus on not just movies and streaming content like Netflix and YouTube, but gaming. They're going to bring the OS gaming experience to the Apple TV.
Well, you just said the magic word when you said it's a game changer. It's going to be about gaming. They're going to do it. I've got an Apple TV tube downstairs. Yep. And I don't think it's as compatible as my Roku box upstairs here.
It's not. Absolutely not. I use Plex, and I can't use Plex on my Apple TVs.
Right.
I can on my Amazon Fire Stick. I can on my PS3s and PS4s, but I can on Apple TV. It's ridiculous.
Well, and I think the key thing there is that they're going to allow you to download apps.
Yeah.
Which you're kind of frozen out of right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we'll see the usual interim upgrades to phones and things like that. But the big focus is going to be, I think, on the Apple TV. What I was trying to say before we got into that tangent, though, is, in my opinion, the Mac OS system and iOS are going to not become so. I don't want to use the word compatible. I'm going to use the word that they're interchangeable in some ways, so that you can actually. Right now, you're like in two different worlds in the Apple world.
Yeah,
and it needs to become one. And that
I don't know. I would disagree with you in that. What? Look, what the Mac does on the desktop to me is far superior than any other computing platform on the desktop.
I agree.
But the Mac OS does not work on a flat screen, you know, iPad or an iPhone. That's why Apple created iOS, because I think they really did see it has to be two separate operating systems so they can both be as strong as possible. Microsoft, for a long time, tried to shove Windows into the phone, even before the iPhone came out. Remember the old smartphones at Microsoft? They had the start menu on a phone. It was ridiculous. So I like Apple's approach of these are two separate devices, two separate use cases. We really need the best for each, and that means two separate operating systems. I agree that we need to bring some of the features from one over to the other, absolutely. But I think they do need to remain separate.
Well, I think you're probably right. I think there's a little bit of truth on both sides of that issue, and we'll have to see how it evolves.
Mm-hmm.
The part that I truly don't buy into yet, I'm learning the hard way, but I'm not buying into the whole concept yet, is the interoperability and the transparency between all the different iOS devices. I think there's some glitches yet that need to be cleaned up.
I totally agree.
And when that happens, we'll see a lot more happy campers in the Apple world.
Isn't it an exciting time to be into technology?
It's amazing. I mean, I'm holding a phone in front of me here that is, I don't know, a gazillion times more powerful than what took us to the moon back in 69. So I think back in the history of computing, because I lived through it all.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll give you a short little C story. We went to put in what they call an integrated array processor, and it had to come in, and this was back in the early 80s in Hawaii, and it had to get in right away. It was a national defense issue. They spent $13 million of our taxpayer dollars to take one off of a ballistic missile submarine that was water-cooled, put it in because they knew that 11 months later the solid-state device would be ready. They'd rip it all back out and spend another $13 million to do that.
Yeah.
And I went through that whole machination of that. And to take that technology, today, all that technology is in a card.
Yeah, it actually is.
And it really truly is. Trust me, I know it is. And things like PDP computers, if you really go back way back in time, those PDP computers that did very specific functions today are literally done on a smartphone.
Yeah, it's an app.
It's an app, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I try to always harp on people, and I know listeners of this show probably are sick of me saying this, but I really don't want people to take, how do I want to say this? I was going to say advantage. It's not the right word. For granted, the technology we have. Your iPhone or even an Android device has almost instant access to anything you want to know. I mean, it's just amazing. I couldn't have imagined this type of technology when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. It's a magic device. Well, it's a magic device, and all we seem to do is complain about them nowadays.
Well, you know,
it drives me crazy.
what I like to tell people and students whenever I talk to them about it is that we've made action verbs out of technology. Nowadays, you say, I'm going to Google something.
Yeah.
You know, that's an action verb.
Yeah.
It's the technology that was there, but we now have made it an action verb out of it, because literally, if I ask around my house and say, well, how should I find out about this or get information about that? My wife looks at me like I'm kind of crazy and says to me, well, just Google it. You get your answer, you know? And so a funny thing last night, I just happened to find him. I was cleaning out the man cave, and I found a whole set of DVDs that were the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 80s or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
I went, you got to be kidding me, because I can remember getting those CDs and throwing away our actual Encyclopedia Britannicas.
Yeah, that was the 90s.
You know, throwing those away. And the logarithmic increase in technology and the rate of change of technology is so fast that we go back to the conversation we started this interview with. We can't keep up with it.
No.
We have to pick our niches, and we have to find useful resources, podcasts, broadcasts, Lynda.com. I could go on and on different places I go to get information, to get up to speed on whatever technology. And I get asked, because of my role here in the Valley, I probably get asked 20 times a week. You know, I'm in a grocery store and people say, hey, John, can you answer me about this? And I'm going, well, yeah, I don't really want to do it in the middle of a grocery store, but, you know, you get caught and you do it.
Oh, absolutely.
And people need to become educated consumers, like I said earlier, of technology and education on technology.
I'm totally with you on that, 100%. All right, John, it's time for the dreaded three random questions. For those who are listening to the show for the first time, anytime I have a special guest on OWC Radio, I go to my list, which I have to repopulate soon. I grab the next three random questions for the next guest. So these questions were not made ahead of time specifically for the guest. So John has no idea what these are. They weren't prepared for him. They're just three random questions.
Go for it.
Number one, if you could be magically endowed with one random skill, you don't have to learn it, you just all of a sudden you have the skill, what would that skill be?
To listen better.
Yeah?
Yeah, really. I have a tendency to talk before I listen.
That's your job part of the time.
Yeah, I know. But I think if I had a skill, I mean a practical skill, I'd like to be a welder. I know it sounds strange, but I would love to take
I wish more younger people would get into welding now, because there's actually a huge market for skilled welders that's just not being fulfilled. I just saw it's a couple months ago, a news article about this. There are not enough skilled welders in the United States for all of the job openings for a skilled welder. If you're a skilled welder nowadays, you can almost write your own ticket, especially if you go up to like North Dakota. It's amazing.
It is, and I came from a technical college background where we do train on welding. And all those years that I was there, 25 years, I always said I want to take a welding course. So I guess besides being a good listener, a better listener, I think I'd like to become a welder.
Mm-hmm. That's a skill that I respect a lot. It's something that I've tried before, and I'm terrible at it.
Well, I've seen a lot of people. I like to think of myself as an embryo artist. I like to mix mediums like glass and wood and things like that together when I create something. And I've seen people do metal welding art that just amazes me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's one of those skills that it's almost falling out of favor, but man, we really do need welders, especially skilled ones. I'm really starting to get into soldering myself.
There you go.
I mean, it's a skill that not a lot of people have nowadays.
Well, I did it for a lot of years and I'm trying to get away from it, but
yeah. Well, I'm repairing or building little mini arcades or full-size arcades machines, like I was talking about earlier, Pac-Man and those type of things. I've got one that runs a PC, but the rest of them are the actual arcades. And you can't just go buy a new monitor. You have to refresh this. You have to put new chips in it. And, you know, the only way you can do that.
Tim, I'm gonna make you laugh. In 1973, out of in Michigan, someplace in Michigan on the east, on the west side, was a company called Heathkit.
Mm-hmm.
And I ordered a Heathkit kit, and I built from scratch a 25-inch color television console.
Cool.
And it worked the first time we turned it on.
Wow, that's saying something.
And that was a lot of soldering, trust me.
But you know what the thing is, when you build something by hand, it's so much more meaningful to you. You know, you get such a, like these, I build these, you've got an iPad, so you've probably seen these little iCades. It's a little sure. Bluetooth controller, looks like a little mini arcade.
Yep.
I'm taking those and I'm turning them into actual arcades. I'm putting a PCB in it, a power source, a monitor, upgrading the joysticks and buttons. I've got one right now that looks like a little mini Donkey Kong. I'm working on a little Pac-Man right now. When I'm done with that, it's, you can't go out to the store and buy this. It's totally unique. The kids liked it at first, and they're like, okay, we want to go play Minecraft again. And you know, I'm not selling these things or anything. They're just for my personal amusement, but I'm building them by hand. And
you know what I have in the basement? I have
what?
In the midst of everything up down there, I discovered it. I open up this box. I have the first video game.
Pong. Do you?
I have the first and second edition of Pong. And the first one, you had to put an acetate on the screen to give it color.
Correct.
And then Atari came out with a chipset for it, and we got color. So it's sitting in a box. I have the original Pong game.
That's awesome. Don't get rid of it either.
No, I won't.
Yeah, like, it's not really all that valuable. They sold like 10 million of them at the time. But it's just really cool.
Yep.
It's really cool. Number two on the three random questions.
Go for it.
If you had to live a decade over and over and over again, just one decade, which decade would it be? So in other words, you're more like a time traveler. So you can live through all the 2000s again, but you got to do it over and over and over. Or the 80s, or the 90s, or the 70s, 60s. Which decade do you choose to live over and over again? With you take the knowledge with you.
Okay. I would go back to the 60s.
Yeah?
I really would. I had a fabulous time during the 60s, besides meeting my bride and all that stuff. But I went around the world three times before I was 18. Twice by air and once by land, once by sea, I mean. I was stationed in San Francisco during the Haight-Ashbury Flower Child Love Summer. I was going to electronic school out on Treasure Island, so I had a chance to witness all of that. And I actually helped out as a gopher assistant sound engineer, tell it what you want, back during the days of Bill Graham and the old Fillmore and the Avalon Ballroom and all that. I just think the 60s were a decade of change. It was good and it was bad and horrible, obviously. I spent some time in Vietnam in 67 and 68. But I think that I experienced more things in one decade than I did in the following three or four decades.
Combined. I think it's an awesome answer. I think for me it would be the 80s, but... That's because I wasn't alive in the 60s. I was born in 1970. Yeah. So would you change anything, though? I mean, your second time through, the third time through, are you still joining?
If I have all the knowledge I have today?
Sure, absolutely.
Boy.
But remember, it resets. But, you know, you go back the third time, everything you just did in the second time through, is it's all reset.
Well, you know, you could go through this long conversation about girlfriends and all that.
I wasn't going there.
Either. As far as... would I change anything? No, I don't know if I would, because the Navy was the best thing that ever happened to me at that time in my life. I knew I wanted to go in the Navy when I graduated. My father was in the Navy. He had died on active duty in the Navy. He was a chief in charge of a radiation survey team at Bikini, and they all died from radiation exposure within 2 years.
Wow.
And as a young boy growing up in the inner city, I was right across the water from the Navy shipyard there, and I was a Sea Scout, Sea Explorer, and took a 50-foot air sea rescue boat all the way to New York City for the World's Fair. I was a navigator. So at a young age, I knew that I was going to go to sea. And more importantly, I think I was – there's an old song that I listened to the other night. It actually applies to me directly. I think I was born under a wandering star, and I had a lust for – seeing the world, and God knows I saw it. I've been around the world about 8 times now in the course of my life.
And the judge really did you a favor, didn't he?
Well, actually, my mother and the judge and my uncle did me a favor, because they decided the night before that he's going to go in the Navy in 8 months when he graduates from high school anyways. Let's get him out before he gets hurt or gets in trouble and let him go now and see what happens. And, you know, I drove the Secretary of the Navy my first year in the Navy in Washington, D.C. Then I went to sea and I started to travel. Then I went overseas to the West Coast, and then I went out to the Pacific. And I mean, I happened to be in the right places at the right time, like a Forrest Gump in a way.
I was just going to say that you were Forrest Gump.
I was like embryo spirit there. I was in the right place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time, if you want to call it that too. I mean, I went in the Navy the day the Gulf of Tonkin started, wow, the whole thing in Vietnam. And, I have no complaints. I got a chance to see some fabulous places, and I didn't get hurt, and I'm here, and been fortunate, and I've had a great career, two or three. Actually, I like to say that I lived three lives in one so far, and I'm looking for the fourth one before I
just
hang it up. So,
the last question.
Yeah.
You're going to think that I just pulled this out of thin air to go along with the last question, but this is truly the next one that was on the list.
Go for it.
John, Paul, Ringo, or George?
Meaning who am I, or which one do I like better?
Take it however you mean.
Okay.
See, when I look at it, I thought I'm going to pick these two, but oh, wait a minute. I don't know.
I'm going to pick one or two or three.
You got to pick one. John, Paul, Ringo, or George?
John, Paul, Ringo, or George?
For those who don't know what we're talking about, if you're too young, this is the Beatles.
I'm going to say I'm a George.
Are you? You're a George.
I'm a George. I don't think that I was the really far out, John. And Paul, I met him again this past, I ran the one of the security teams for the NFL owner's private tailgate party at Super Bowl this year. And I had a chance to shake his hand. He came through my security system. And he is a fascinating guy. I enjoyed his company. But he's too...
Royalty?
Too methodical for me.
Oh, gotcha.
And I'm sorry, but Ringo is just too way out there. So
nobody ever will pick Ringo. Ringo will be the one that no one ever picks.
I'd say I'm a George Harrison.
Yep. Yeah, George was awesome.
Yeah, he was just awesome. He kind of hung back in the wings, but when he came up forward, I always truly enjoyed what he did. So I'll say George.
I listen to quite a few different types of podcasts. Technology obviously isn't the only thing I'm interested in. And one of the shows I was listening to, they started talking about some of the all-time great drummers. And the last person to speak said, no one ever mentions this, but Ringo Starr was an incredible drummer, and he just never gets the recognition. You would think he would. I mean, he was in the Beatles, for goodness sakes. But he doesn't get the recognition that he probably deserves. If you really go back and listen to those Beatles, his drumming was just amazing.
Yeah, I would like to have seen Ringo Starr on one side and Jack Bruce on the other side of the stage with a set of traps, because Jack was the and then there was Larry Taylor from Canned Heat, I think that's one of them. Anyways, three good drummers that I know of in my lifetime. Ringo was one of them, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think I watched Jack Bruce take an 8-foot Fender Stratocaster bass out on the stage and with super slinky strings, and I didn't think anybody could play that, and he did a fabulous job with it. So, but basically, George.
I came down between John and George myself. I'm still not sure, so I'll let that linger out there. John, I really want to thank you for coming on OWC Radio this week. I had a great time talking to you. I want to wish you all the best success in the world. Hopefully you do have this fourth life coming up like you were speaking of. And, hey, keep in touch. We'd love to have you back on the show sometime and talk about other things. We can discuss the current state of technology, not just you, but maybe we can expand it sometime. I'd love to have you on the show again.
Well, like I said, I do CES every year, and I try to pick up those pearls and find out what's going to be next. And I'm going to look forward to working with OWC, for example, on mass storage and what do you do when you're done with video and all that stuff. So that's another project with them. So we just keep moving on, and we'll just keep trying on. And I keep flying, I keep diving, I keep bouncing my grandchildren, and technology keeps changing every bloody moment. So it's like, here we go. It's fun every day. Look at it.
Thanks, John.